Hello and welcome to another Linguistics CareerCast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Joan Barker received a master's in linguistics at Central Connecticut State University and spent much of her career abroad, holding positions in Africa and the Middle East. She's worked as a technical consultant, writer, instructor, and trainer, contracting with the Department of Defense to design and implement language courses. She's currently employed here in the States as a public safety officer. Topics discussed include the Peace Corps, TESOL, technical writing, cross-cultural communication, government contracting, and language instruction. Links to Joan's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. And if you think you'd be a good guest on the show, or you'd like to recommend a linguist for me to interview, please fill out the contact form on the website at linguisticscareercast.com. I would like to welcome our guest this week, Joan Barker. Joan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I am delighted to have you because I think you're the first person who's been involved in your particular kind of work, which we'll get to in a little bit. And I think people will be really interested to hear what you do now in general terms and how your linguistics got you there. But first question that I always ask is, how did you find out about linguistics and decide that that's what you were going to study?
Well, it was a little bit accidental for me. I had done the Peace Corps after college.
Oh, interesting. Cool.
After I completed my Peace Corps service, I knew that I wanted to go back overseas and teach English. My assignment in the Peace Corps was not directly teaching English, but it's something I ended up doing in a village that I was assigned to in rural Niger, which bordered Nigeria, northern Nigeria. So a lot of people that I worked with in this rural village were farmers, and on the off season when they weren't farming, they would go to Nigeria to work in the markets, and they wanted to learn English so that they could do that. So I was just teaching sort of casually, but I just fell in love with teaching. I was on a health assignment, but I just really gravitated towards the teaching. And so when I came home back to the U.S. after my 2 years of Peace Corps service, I enrolled in a graduate degree program at Central Connecticut State University from Connecticut, and they had a TESOL program, and all the coursework was linguistics. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to learn about linguistics. So it was, you know, like syntax, phonology, sociolinguistics, like a whole like smattering of linguistics courses, and then some teaching practicums. And I ended up doing volunteer teaching at night with refugees and immigrants in the community of Hartford at the Adult Education Center. So yeah, I just was doing my coursework during the day, supplementing that with teaching at night, and did that for about 4 years. And then I can talk to you about what happened after that. But I got that TESOL master's degree and then went back overseas and taught for about a decade on and off.
Oh, wow. So before you did your Peace Corps service, were you fluent in languages other than English?
So I had studied French starting in middle school on the public school system I was in. You could choose Spanish or French in seventh grade, and I just chose French. And so I did that through high school. And then when I got to college, I continued studying French. I don't know how fluent I was speaking. Like, I was pretty well versed in reading and writing the language, but I had gone to France for 3 weeks on a little study abroad trip. So I had a decent command of the language. So I was selected to go to a program in Niger, which is a Francophone country in West Africa, like French speaking. In other words, like the government and the schools run in French. But most of us in that program were sent out to rural villages where nobody spoke French or English. So we had to learn, a local language. And so I learned Hausa, which is the local language in the area of Niger that I was. And pretty much just learned it from immersion, being in the village. The Peace Corps did have 2 months up front when we got into country in July of 2005. We had 2 months where we had language instruction in the capital city, in a place right outside of Niamey. And so local language instructors would just teach us all day long for 2 months. And then we had to pass a language test in order to be deemed safe enough to be assigned to a rural post by ourselves. So, you know, most of us passed that and got sent out into the rural villages. And there was, again, like there was no English, no French. It was just learning that language as much as you could, as quickly as you could, which I think opened my eyes to what language learning is really about, right? Because there's a huge difference between sitting in a classroom in your school learning French like 1 hour a day, like three times a week with a teacher that's teaching you bilingually, and you can see all the words and it's like a written language in front of you, versus being in a place where a lot of the words were not, there was no written language in the village I was in. There was pretty much like a 0% literacy rate. So it was just learning from having conversations with people and listening to them, and then, you know, trying to get a grasp of the grammar and the vocabulary that way. So, which again, like later on down the line, opened my eyes to a lot of the students that I work with who were refugees resettling in the U.S. from other countries, what they were going through in the United States.
Exactly.
Not knowing the Latin alphabet, or maybe they're fluent in three or four languages from their country, but they never were, they never went to school, for example, and maybe didn't have that literacy. So there's just different things that impact on how people learn language. So that was very eye-opening for me to be in that position and to have that experience.
Wow, amazing. And plus, you were trying to do your Peace Corps job at the same time that you were learning a language, right? I mean, that sounds extremely challenging.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Peace Corps is just a wide variety of assignments across the world. And, you know, some people are in country assignments where, like, you know, they're in Eastern Europe or the Caribbean, and they have like Wi-Fi and they live in apartments and they go to a job in an office every day. And then our experience in Niger at the time in the early 2000s was in these rural villages, mostly with no electricity, no Wi-Fi, no cell phone, no connection to the outside world. So you have these vastly different job assignments. And so for us, the language was paramount to what we were doing. Mm. Paramount to our security and our ability to do our job, which was mostly to create buy-in with local communities to engage in educational, agricultural, and health initiatives that we were trying to spearhead. So the first 6 months for us in Niger, our assignment was just to learn the language. Mm-hmm. So that, again, like that's not necessarily what happens in every Peace Corps assignment, is all I'm trying to say, is where we were told by our, you know, country director and our supervisors, just focus on learning the language. You're not going to be able to do your job until you have that command of the language and you can engage with people, understand their culture and their religion and all these other factors that tie into whether or not you're going to get that buy-in or how you approach these topics with people, some of which are taboo. Like I lived in a completely, it was a Muslim village, very conservative Muslim village. And my assignment was to go talk about birth control as a woman, you know, like, and so it's, that's a challenging thing as it is. So you got to make sure you have the right level of language and cultural knowledge and religious knowledge to be able to engage with community leaders in a respectful way and, you know, bring up, and in that topic, it wasn't just to go, you know, introduce people to birth control. It was, there was a high mortality rate in that village where I was, maternal mortality and infant mortality. And this was, you know, trying to introduce people to the Western health systems that existed in the surrounding cities in Niger, and how to get people connected with that and to help combat those mortality rates. But yeah, language was number one before anything else.
Amazing. And really pointing you towards linguistics as a calling, I would say. Yeah. So you're doing this, and this is before you got your master's in linguistics, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I graduated my undergraduate. I finished in 2004 from Providence College. I'd studied history and French was my minor. And in 2005 to 2007, I went to Niger in the Peace Corps. And then when I came back to the U.S. in 2007 is when I entered that grad program for linguistics.
Okay. And so you got a master's in linguistics. And then what happened?
So I didn't know what I was going to do. Like I said, I knew I wanted to go back overseas and continue to work in other countries. I loved being in Niger because it just opened my eyes to a culture I would have never otherwise knew existed or anything about. And I knew I wanted to get back out there and keep finding other places to work. And so I went on to TESOL.org at the time was just becoming this really big, great place where you could go online and make connections and see the job boards. So I went to the TESOL.org career tab and was just looking for jobs overseas, universities and like the Middle East and Asia that required a master's degree. And, you know, I had to pay back my student loan. So I was like, I need to get like a good job, like in a university. And that's what I was looking for. And then this random job popped up in the United Arab Emirates. outside of Abu Dhabi on a military base. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I read more about it. And it was like a partnership between the U.S. Embassy and the Emirati military, because that's a partner force in the United States. We help train their troops. And what they needed was some English training to help facilitate the U.S. military, Emirati military training that was going on between our two militaries. And I thought, well, I don't qualify for this job. I have no experience doing this. But I applied anyways, because I thought, like, this would be a really cool thing to go do and learn how to do, like, teach soldiers English. Like, why not? Mm-hmm. And it was a Muslim country. And I really liked learning about the Muslim culture when I was in Niger. And I felt comfortable in that environment. And I thought, let me go try to apply for this job. And then I got it. Well, I didn't get it at first. They filled up those spots and then a guy quit. So I was contacted a month later and they say, hey, a spot opened up. Would you still like to go? And this was September of 2011. I had just signed 3 adjunct teaching contracts. Every ESL teacher knows if you're trying to teach ESL in the United States, you're probably going to be adjuncting at first. So I had signed like 3 part-time job contracts and had all my classes lined up. And then I get this call from this company that was contracted to provide teachers for this U.S. Embassy project. And she said, do you still want to go? And I was like, well, I have to quit 3 jobs now, but yes, I do want to go. So I did that. And by October of 2011, I was on a plane to Dubai to go teach on that contract. And so I did that for about a year and a half.
Wow. And that was without you knowing any Arabic?
Yeah, I knew no Arabic. If anybody's ever been to the UAE and the bigger cities of Dubai and Abu Dhabi, a lot of people speak English. When I was there in 2011, I'm not sure the numbers now, but back then it was the ratio of like foreigners and expats to locals was like 9 to 1. In other words, there were 1 million-ish Emirati citizens and then 9 million expats, people from the UK, Australia, Brazil, India, the United States, all there working in the tourism industry, in the tech industry, education. So it's a huge like metropolitan area. So it's, you know, that was one of my biggest concerns when I got hired. I was like, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to drive or get to work? And I can't read the signs. And the company was like, you don't need to know Arabic. So when I showed up, we lived in a group of apartments. There was like 10 U.S. English teachers. We lived together in this apartment block in Dubai, and we commute every morning to this military base out in the desert and teach for like 6-7 hours a day based on a U.S. military teaching curriculum that was provided to us. So that was all pretty straightforward. And we were just supposed to be getting these new recruits for the Emirati military, just get them like a baseline of English. And then what I would do in my classes was, like, if we had extra time at the end of the day, if we'd gotten through our lessons, I would give a student the whiteboard marker and be like, all right, come teach me, like teach me some Arabic.
Oh, okay, so like,
which
cool.
They loved. It was hilarious because they loved getting to be like the teacher. And so they would, you know, try to teach me the alphabet and like write it out on the board. And that was so hard for me. It was the Arabic script. But they taught me some conversational phrases and words. And I got to the point by the end of a year and a half where I was conversational enough in Arabic to just, you know, make introductions or greet them in the morning when I got to class and things like that. And I just thought that was so cool. But again, very eye-opening experience when you're trying to learn a language where, you know, most of the time in the U.S., if we're learning languages in our public schools or private schools, you're learning Spanish or French or, you know, German. And the alphabet is pretty much the same, right? So, you can still like, you know, sound things out to yourself. But when you're looking at the Arabic alphabet at first, you're just like, oh my God, how am I ever going to wrap my head around this?
I took Japanese when I was in graduate school, and Japanese, the language is pretty, I mean, it's not simple, but it makes sense. And then trying to learn the written language was like, I can't do this. That's way too complicated. So I feel you on that. I'm just wondering, as you're talking, were you the only linguist in your group that was assigned, or were there other linguists?
No. So the majority of the group of 10 were either previous ESL teachers, or they had also gotten master's degrees in TESOL or linguistics. So most of us were on the same page, in the same age range, like 20s, 30s.
I'm just wondering how your linguistics background might have prepared you differently. I was going to say better, but I think differently is what I'm looking for here than some of the other folks who might not have had linguistic training.
We did have some teachers who didn't have a linguistics background. There was a couple of teachers there as well. I think one was from, I forget if he was from Algeria, but it was a northern African country. And then another fella, I forget what country he was from, but everybody had their different teaching styles, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think having a linguistics background, you know, specifically learning about things like phonology and, you know, pronunciation patterns or sociolinguistics and why somebody might have a difficult time, like, you know, interacting with you in a certain way when they're trying to use the language. Obviously, as a female teacher in a room full of male Emirati cadets, there's a lot of things going on there besides the language and how they respond to you as an instructor versus a male instructor. So there's a lot that goes into it that I'm glad that I had that background of that, you know, 3.5 years of grad school, like learning all about that so that I knew, like, when I'm in a classroom situation, if students aren't grasping something, what are some of the challenges they might be facing from their like L1 standpoint or, what might be the reason that they're hesitant to participate? Is that something more sociolinguistics related? So I just, you know, it was kind of helped me be the detective I needed to be as a teacher when a student wasn't getting it or when there was an issue in the classroom. It's like, well, maybe this isn't just like a lack of ability to learn or somebody not wanting to participate. It could be a lot of other things going on here in their brain. And so I think it's helpful to go in with that context. And to have that background, it makes you a stronger instructor because you have more tools and just more insight into what's going on into the brain of a language learner.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Awesome. That's really good. So you're doing that. You said you were there for like a year and a half, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And then what happened?
So the company that I worked for that was in charge of facilitating this teaching contract, it was, so the U.S. Embassy funded this operation, but it was a small defense contracting company out of Washington, D.C. that actually hired us as teachers and flew us over there and, you know, took care of all the financial stuff, like getting our visas, getting us housing. Well, what I didn't realize was that company was working other contracts in the U.S. with the U.S. military, specifically the U.S. Special Operations Command. So at the time, this was 2013 when I came back to the U.S., after the working in the UAE, the company that had sent me over there was like, hey, would you like to come back to Washington, D.C. and help us work on some of these contracts for the U.S. military? They want to engage in language and culture training for U.S. soldiers to train those U.S. soldiers before they deploy overseas. And I was like, absolutely. Sign me up. That sounds fascinating. And it was. So basically, at that point, the U.S. military was, you know, a little over a decade into the war on terror and was all over the Middle East and was realizing that, you know, at that point, I think the whole idea of winning hearts and minds was, you know, a major goal for the U.S. military. How do we do that when a lot of U.S. soldiers are very well trained in technical aspects of their job, but language and culture had never been at the forefront? Right. And at that time, the U.S. Special Operations Command was, you know, leading the way in training people with like function-based language and culture training that they would need when they would deploy overseas to help bridge cultural barriers and build trust with cultural partners and help facilitate training with partner forces. So I thought that was really fascinating. I wanted to be part of that. And so I got to come back and do that for about 4 years on and off.
It seems like it was true then, and I'm asking you, is it true now? Once you work for a contractor like that and they like you, it seems like you're now in their database and it's likely that they'll tap you for similar work or related work doing the same kind of stuff before they'll look outside for somebody new. Is that true? Like you then become part of their roster and they might, you know, if they've got something similar and they like what you did before, they'll give you a call because you're in the network.
Yes. I definitely found that to be true with that company I worked for and they helped refer me to other jobs. You know, cause it's tough when a contract ends, that company is waiting for the government to maybe approve the next contract and you're out of a job until that happens. So,
right.
You know, people in that community will try to, you know, if there's other opportunities out there, we'll try to refer you. And I definitely found that to be true. It becomes a really niche job where there's just a specific technical training that needs to be done with these special operations groups and like what they need. And so if you learn how to do that, learn what they need, it's the government likes that because you're somebody they can bring right in and say like, hey, like we need this language or, you know, this cross-cultural knowledge. Like, and a lot of what we did was I wasn't teaching that, but I would help recruit native language speakers from other countries. Mm-hmm. And I would supervise them as they develop language and culture courses for these groups. So if we had, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, DC is a very diverse area. There's lots of folks from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, all these countries. And so, and Somalia, we would, you know, if they wanted to, they would come in and we would train them on how to create these courses that would help, you know, empower these teams downrange and help bridge those cross-culture barriers. Mm-hmm. So I loved it because I was around, again, so many different cultures all the time. Mm-hmm. That building that we worked in DC was, I mean, there's people from like 80 different countries in the building, like every day. And it's just, it was, and they really focused on, you know, people that were those language and culture instructors from those countries ended up working in the company in like HR and finance. So it's just mm-hmm. a very diverse environment that was very empowering for those folks. And I just, it was really cool to be a part of that. We created some really great work and helped some really important military teams do what they needed to do. So,
yeah. What kind of security clearance did you need to have those kinds of jobs?
So the work that I did was I mostly just did like supervision of those language and culture teams. And I did some technical writing, but I actually didn't need to have a security clearance. My supervisors did. And there was folks mm-hmm. in our program that did. And unfortunately, when I left that job or when our contracts dried up, it was very hard for me to continue finding work in that sphere because a lot of companies do require security clearances because you do have, you know, access to certain people and knowledge. But the work that I was specifically doing didn't require that. Mm-hmm. So I never had to get a security clearance.
But, I was just thinking too, if you're working for the government or government related organizations and you've already got a certain level of security clearance, it's probably easier for you to continue that kind of work because you're already like a known quantity, right? They don't have to clear you again if you've got a certain level. So that is also a benefit to doing that kind of work, getting clearance, then more people will hire you because they know you, who you are, and that you're quote unquote safe to work with.
Like if there's a company that's going to hire you and they say, you're going to get a security clearance through this, like I would say hop on that because a lot of companies don't want to pay for it and it's an expensive process. So I would highly recommend if you have the chance to get one, just get it. You never know when it'll come in handy. You can keep re-upping it. So
exactly. Okay, cool. In many of the interviews that I've done, we talk always about the importance of networking, and there are big networks and small networks. And what you're describing is, as you said, it's a very niche kind of network, but so important to keep that up, right? Because these kinds of jobs are very, very specialized, and it seems like everybody probably knows each other. But if this is a kind of work that you enjoy, and you have these very specialized skills, the network is all important to finding new jobs. When these new contracts come up, people will know who you are and the kind of work that you've done, and they're going to look for you when something new comes along.
Yeah, that's very true. And I've tried to keep in touch with the folks I know, and I've met some really cool people through LinkedIn too, just being that network. So I just, any networking you can do.
Yeah,
for sure.
So what was the next step for you after that part ended? You said that was like 4 years, right?
Yeah. So about 2017 timeframe, the priorities with the U.S. military were starting to shift a little bit as the war on terror was drawing down and priorities were shifting. Language and culture is still happening, but it just, the contracts were fewer and further between. And if anyone's lived in D.C., you know, like you can't really hang out there if you don't have a job. Like it's so expensive. So I was out of a contract for a few months and I was bartending in Alexandria. And I was like, I can't keep doing this. I got to go back overseas. And I had a friend or a contact that I had worked in the UAE with was working over in Kabul in Afghanistan on an English teaching contract there. So basically what we were doing in the UAE, training the Emirati forces in English, there were other contracts in Afghanistan doing that with the Afghan military, training their air force in English because the U.S. was there training the Afghans. And, you know, there were some language gaps between the U.S. troops and the Afghan troops. So I I kept in touch with my contacts there. And one day I just said, look, you know, do you know of any companies there that are hiring? And I got a few leads. I applied to one company that needed an English teacher real quick. And that was like April 2017. And I was on a plane in the summer to Afghanistan. So I was there in Kabul from 2017 to 2018. Did one straight year there on the military base in Kabul. So if you remember a few years ago in 2021, when the Taliban took over and that whole, like, you might have seen people getting on the gray cargo planes, the C-17s, and getting flown out of Afghanistan. That airport, the Kabul International Airport, was attached to a larger NATO military base with NATO and U.S. troops. So that airport, that's where I lived for a year, on the military base that was attached to that airport. So that was like my home for a year. And yeah, I can talk about that work if you want me to.
Can I just say, so you have a high tolerance for travel. And it also sounds like you have a pretty high tolerance for, I don't want to say danger, because I don't think that's it, but for, I don't know, unexpected situations or, you know, just like crazy things happening, which I totally admire. Like, I could never do this.
I like going places where, like, I see some of these people, for example, on Instagram that are like travel influencers and they're in a new place every other day. And I'm like, that is too exhausting for me. Anytime I've worked overseas, it's been like, I go and I have a home and I'm there for months at a time or years at a time. And I can get immersed in one place. And like, I'm, you know, but to your point, I mean, people have asked me this question, like, how do you go from like the Peace Corps to like working in like combat zones and like, what's that all about? But for me, it was very stressful to be in the United States trying to make this career happen. I wanted to be an ESL teacher. I wanted to teach folks. And it's hard when either those jobs are not paying bills or, you know, I was working as a contractor and being in and out of work, to me, having a secure job, even if it's in a far away or dangerous place, like having a stable paycheck and health insurance, like as an American, like I was just like, I'll go wherever I need to go. And so I hate to boil it down to that. I am somebody that wants to go out and seeks out these opportunities overseas, but I wasn't scared of going there. To me, it was just like, this is an exciting opportunity to do something I'm never going to get the opportunity to do again. How many people can get on a plane and get asked to go do this? And, you know, we're there at the behest of the U.S. military. It's a U.S. defense contract, but the Department of Defense is essentially providing your security on that base. Like, where we lived alongside active duty troops, even though we were civilian contractors as teachers there. So I felt very safe all the time. It was a NATO base with U.S. troops. We had, how do I describe it to people in non-technical terms, but like the anti-missiles, like we had like, like protection around the base. So we weren't getting like bombed, and I felt pretty safe there, which I don't know if people believe me or not, but
I totally see it. And you just said something so important, and I like 100% the precarity of trying to pursue the kind of career that you're talking about, like wanting to essentially do good, right? Like you're wanting to teach people English, you're wanting to improve their lives, to actually give them something that is going to lift them up in our society, like teaching them English. What a basic thing to do, to do it in a great way. And you can't make a living doing that in the US right now. Like you can't, you just can't, because there's no funding for it. There's no security. There's nothing for you. Like you said, you had three part-time jobs just to live, and you can barely afford to live on that. And that's the way it is all across this country. Like that's insane. It's just an insane thing. So your decision to pursue this by going out of the US totally makes sense. It is the only thing that you could do. And, you know, I am in awe that you had the guts to go ahead and do this. Like, I don't know. I am a hermit. So it is not the thing that I would choose to do, but it's amazing that you did this and you've turned it into this incredible career. having all these experiences and going to these, you know, far-flung places to do it. It's incredible. So please continue. I just wanted to, I'm looking at all these places that you went to and have done all these different things, and it's incredible. So go
well,
on, please.
Like my favorite job in the entire world that I ever did was I was teaching U.S. citizenship to that group of refugees and immigrants from like 2010 to 2011 before I went to the UAE. My favorite job in the entire world. If I could do that full time and make a living, like I would do that in a heartbeat, because it is so rewarding to watch folks that you've taught like pre-literate beginner ESL to work through the process of getting their green card and then applying for U.S. citizenship, helping them study for that exam, and then going to a naturalization ceremony. Like I cried like a baby every time. I was like, this is the American dream. These folks have come from war-torn countries, lived through trauma we can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. And then they come to a country where people are like, why don't you speak English? You go back to work. You know, like the worst things that you could say to somebody who's just trying to come here and survive. And it's not easy. Like when I've gone abroad and I don't know the language in the country I'm in, like we are given such grace as Americans and English speakers. And I've always had the support of the government I'm working for or the company I'm working for. For these folks to come here, like refugees and immigrants with the clothes on their back, you know, limited public assistance, and then they're supposed to be on their feet in 6 months. Like, and they talk about working three jobs, like that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And so, and then, you know, they show up to my English class for an hour a week. And, you know, I just have the utmost respect for people that come here and have to go through that just to get on their feet after everything they've been through. Mm-hmm. And to see somebody at a U.S. citizenship ceremony, like, now they're an American, like it's, oh God, like I can't even, I'll get emotional if I keep talking about it, but that was such a hard job to leave because that was something where I'm like, I believe in this. I believe in making a difference for these folks. And like, what am I if I can't give back to folks that are going through this? So it's hard to have to leave stuff like that and take opportunities mostly out of, you know, that financial need. But, you know, again, like it did open doors, and every opportunity I took abroad was another learning experience for me that I got to bring home to the work I do here.
Yeah.
But, I would like to talk about Afghanistan real quick. Cause I think that was a,
please.
Kind of leads into what I did after I came home from there. But, my job was to teach English to Afghan air crews. So there were U.S. military, in Kabul on that military base that had an airport runway. The U.S. military was training the Afghans to fly surveillance planes and like air support helicopters for the Afghan ground troops. And our job was to just get them again like a baseline of English so it was easier for them to speak with their American counterparts and learn from them the things they needed to learn from them as far as operating the aircraft and speaking with the air traffic controllers in Kabul at the airport. So we would leave our, you know, secure NATO portion of the compound every morning and go over to the Afghan military base, which was right next door, where they had all the planes and the helicopters, and we would go teach for 5-6 hours a day. It was the same curriculum that I'd used in the United Arab Emirates. Again, it was like a military designated English curriculum that the U.S. military had already developed like years ago. It had like some technical military language in it, you know, getting these guys language that was appropriate for the job they're doing, not just like how to go order pizza or go to the shopping mall. Basically we would do that. And then at the end of the day, the Afghans would go back to their barracks for the night and we would go back to our barracks on the U.S. military side. And that's basically what we did for that year.
And so you said that was for a year, correct?
Yes. So I finished my contract in 2018. The company I worked for had phased out the English contract. And so I was out of a job and I went back to the U.S. The company I'd worked for in D.C. had some remote work for me because it was like at that time, COVID was like starting up like the next year. And so everything went remote. And the company that I had been working for in Washington, D.C. said, hey, we have some more technical writing contracts, you know, part time, but would you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, sure. Like anything right now, I don't have a job. Mm-hmm. And then, so that was like during COVID. After COVID, 2020, when COVID was still going on, but that's when Afghanistan was falling back to the Taliban. And so at that point, a lot of the Afghans that I worked with, these soldiers, and a lot of the English and Dari interpreters that we used when we were on the military base, like local interpreters, all those folks became trapped in Kabul, and there was this massive effort to try to relocate them to mm-hmm. safety. So, you know, folks listening to this podcast, if they were, you know, tuning into the news, you might have heard about the SIV applicants, the special immigration visa mm-hmm. SIV applicants who were, some of them were combat interpreters that were embedded with U.S. troops out in, you know, combat missions, which we did not partake in that. But there were also interpreters that the U.S. companies and the U.S. Department of Defense used on a daily basis in Kabul on the military base where we worked. We had interpreters around us all the time helping facilitate our training programs. And so all these guys were trapped in Kabul, afraid for their lives, fearing that they would be retaliated against by the Taliban because they had been working with the U.S. for so many years. And so I got looped into this operation to try to get these guys out. A lot of the U.S. soldiers that I had met in Afghanistan, U.S. veterans, U.S. veterans turned defense contractors, we were all just trying to lobby Congress, like calling congressmen and congresswomen that weren't even from my district or my state, just calling everyone in the United States saying like, hey, we can't leave these guys behind. They're going to die, you know, like they're targets mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up writing a series of op-eds in 2021, like in the fall of 2021, just trying to get the word out there that, hey, like these guys sacrificed their lives and their safety and their family safety to work for us and to support that U.S. mission to combat terrorism in that country and limit it so that, you know, the reason we were there was post 9/11. We never want that to happen again. And these Afghans sacrificed their safety to make mm-hmm. sure that we were safe here. And so, you know, that was this huge thing that went on like that year, you know, after the Taliban took things over. And we were able to get some folks here to safety. The U.S. State Department did continue working with the Qatari government and the Taliban throughout 2021, 2022, up to 2023, I think into last year. There were flights still happening where the Taliban did allow these folks out that had worked in the United States. For the United States, there was like an agreement to get them out, and they said they would not harm them. So that was kudos to the U.S. State Department, because that was not a program that was going on right after Kabul fell. But because of the advocacy of those, a lot of those veterans groups in the fall that, you know, were lobbying Congress and the White House, the State Department ended up brokering this deal to help get some of those SIV, special immigrant visa interpreters, out of Afghanistan. So that was like a really, I think, like a life-changing movement to be a part of, because mm-hmm. it's like the only thing that was, I think the baseline of all that advocacy was the human connection that yeah. a lot of these American veterans felt to these Afghans who they had bonded with, working with them for years and being on dangerous missions together and burying brothers and sisters in arms together. And then what comes out of it in the end, like the reason you're able to bond with people is because you share, you know, you try to learn each other's language and you try to learn each other's cultural norms mm-hmm. and you share, you drink tea together or you share like kebabs together. I mean, these sound like trivial things, but it's like these U.S. troops and these Afghan troops like bonded so deeply. It was like they were true brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And so it just speaks to the power of language and culture and why I'm proud to have pursued this career and been a part of the opportunities that I've been a part of.
Yeah. I think it, what you said, you know, it really shows the difference between the people who are actually involved in the, as I say, boots on the ground kind of work that gets done versus, yeah. oh, I don't know, the people at the top yeah. who make some of these decisions. Because as we've seen very, very recently, you know, the people at the top of our government have reversed a lot of the feelings about what should be done with those people who, as you so eloquently talked about, you know, sacrificed yeah. their lives. And it's like, well, you know, we let them stay here for a while, but let's just deport them now.
Yeah.
Which is what's been happening. Is like, well, that's not fair, man. We said they could come here, and now yeah. we're saying let's just send them back, which is
it's like a horrifying,
it's horrible
thing to
yeah.
hear. Anytime I turn on the news and I hear about what, you know, Stephen Miller or the Trump administration wants to do with Afghans, it's like yeah. it's to me inhumane. And I there's a group called Afghan Evac, acanyvac.org, and they've been spearheading a lot of these efforts and keeping folks in the loop about what legislation is coming down the pipeline. When those relocation flights stopped, like, that was an initiative by this government to say, like, that's it, we're done bringing people in. Mm-hmm. But now what's happening with people once they're here? And it's tough because, as somebody who began my career in teaching ESL and working in that refugee resettlement sphere, to watch how those programs have been defunded and mm-hmm. watch how support for folks has gone away. I mean, the Afghans that came here in 2021 and 2022, some of them had no support. I mean, they're texting us, people they knew that they worked with, they're texting us saying, like, I don't have groceries this week, or, you know, I don't have, mm-hmm. they were supposed to give us money for an apartment this month. I have no money. Like, what am I going to do? And it's like, then again, they're trying to navigate this in a second language, and they might have left half of their family behind in Kabul. They're dealing with this traumatic family separation and watching mm-hmm. their country fall apart. And it's, I don't know. I think the reason why I want to continue this work and have loved going to other countries is just experiencing humanity on different levels. Mm-hmm. And so when you are in an environment where you see people that are engaging in the highest levels of inhumanity, it just makes you feel like helpless. I don't understand that mindset. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go off on a political tangent here, but it is hard as somebody that I've worked the bulk of my life with Muslim cultures and living in Muslim countries and having Muslim families like take me in and take care of me and watch the struggle that people go through to get on their feet here and how they become business owners and their kids are valedictorians. And then we lump them all into a group and say the worst things about them,
yeah.
you know, completely unfounded. It's hard as a linguist, as a cross-cultural mm-hmm. Consultant. It's like, this has been my life's work. And so, you know, I just like to speak up when I have a platform or where I can and say, like, I know we're better than this. And I know, again, having worked in that U.S. citizenship pipeline, I know what coming here means to people from other countries that don't have a lot of the freedoms and the safeguards we have. Like, I don't take any of that for granted. I'm not, you know, anti-American. I criticize my government when I feel like my government can be better and what we stand for, what people in the world think that we stand for and why they want to come here. And why they're so gracious to Americans when we are in their country and when I've been in their country is because of what we stand for. And we can't afford that to put that in jeopardy.
Yeah, I think you are incredibly well placed to speak about this. And I'm glad you are. And I'm glad you're doing it here because it's all bound up in all of the things that you talked about. And language and culture are indivisible in so many ways. And not just in the country where you were, but here. And, you know, this English only garbage is ridiculous. And I think often now, of course, you can't help but, you know, Minneapolis and all the Somali people who are there and, you know, the language is part of that too, right? It's like, what is the big deal about people speaking another language? I don't understand it. It's so weird. And
I think, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead. It's just, I don't understand it at all. I was even just flashing too about the Spanish at the Super Bowl halftime show. It's like, what is wrong with people? I don't get it. I just don't understand it.
I think a lot of people grow up in communities where they've never known anything but English, right? Like the majority of Americans don't have passports. I feel lucky that I've been afforded the opportunities I have to travel. And I know for some people that's either not a possibility or just not something that they grew up with. And I think that that's just a level of like, not having that exposure, not even understanding that in our country, we don't have a national language. Technically, on paper, we don't. But a lot of people don't understand that. And I think it's, you know, people are, the way that our media works now, social media, people are, you know, trained to be afraid of the other. And we other very well here. And, you know, I've tried to put up posts about, you know, like the Somalis that I've worked with or the Somali interpreters that we used on those government contracts in D.C. who they came here, got their U.S. citizenship and decided to turn around and go work for the intelligence community to train U.S. you know, intelligence agencies and the U.S. military on Somali language and culture. Yeah. You know, so it's like that's the most patriotic thing you can do. And yet they're lumped into, you know, these stereotypes that, you know, some very ignorant people at the top of our administration, unfortunately, you know, they say like the worst things. And it's unfortunate that that's what's being highlighted versus the hard work that these folks do to contribute to our communities on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I'm always going to be a champion for immigrants and refugees. And, you know, I mean, that's That's all I'm going to say on that right now.
Yeah, no, no. And so, you know, take some linguistics classes, broaden your mind. It'll help. It really will. And I want to bring it back to you say what you want to say. And then after that, I want to talk a little bit about the technical writing thing, but please go on and make your next point.
Well, I just, one thing that I did in 2021 and 2022 was I was being invited on other podcasts to speak to everything that was going on with the Afghan relocation efforts in 2021. And my biggest push for the regular American citizen, it was like, how can I get involved? How can I help? Because there was a broad bipartisan support for bringing Afghans here. It was like, anytime I got the opportunity to tell people how they could help, I said, go look up your local refugee resettlement agency. Just Google Refugee Resettlement Boston or Refugee Resettlement Chicago. Find the organization, whether it's, you know, Lutheran Services or Catholic Charities, those usually these religious-based organizations that are federally funded to resettle refugees. And that's where I got my start teaching ESL, was working for Catholic Charities in Hartford, teaching English, you know, at night, day classes and night classes. If you can just go do that once a week for 1 hour, like, it will change your life. Mm-hmm. You're going to go and have students from 40 different countries speaking 10 different languages who are going to cook food for you, invite you to their holiday gatherings. It's just the most exposure you can get to the world living in the United States is finding ways to connect with immigrants in your community. Mm-hmm. So that was something that I was encouraging people to do, like go work a food kitchen or an English class or collect donations or go sit with somebody and eat a meal in their apartment. These folks, a lot of them did not have cars when they came here. They're trapped in, you know, being resettled in places like Maine or Minnesota, or, you know, it's cold. They're just in an apartment all day long and they have no social, like no healthy social life. Mentally, it's just so challenging for them. Like a lot of them suffered with anxiety and depression. And so I would encourage people to just, you know, go hang out with the family and just talk to them, just be their neighbor. So when that all happened in 2021, when the Afghans were all being flown over here, the ones that were able to escape, they were being housed on U.S. military bases before they were resettled into communities around the United States. And I had, again, another fortunate opportunity where I was asked to go to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, where 12,000 of these Afghans were being housed. And I helped a group of people teach English up there, like basic survival English for when they got to their communities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess that brings us now to where I was in 2022. But, you know, that was, again, like a very rewarding experience for me, but it was me trying to speak to other people like in the local communities and say like, here's how you can help, you know, and people want, I think, you know, there's a lot we see on TV, again, on social media, that's very divisive. But at the end of the day, what I've noticed about Americans from both sides is that like, we want to help people. Like Americans are very good helpers. Like we do, I think, engage, like right now, there's a lot of divisiveness and a lot of othering. But I think at the end of the day, when people like look at their direct neighbor or somebody in the street that's like in need of help, whether it's their car broke down or they're lost, like we help people. That is a very like known cultural thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of Americans that we are going to, if we see someone like having a tough time, like we're going to step in and help. And so that was reassuring to me at the time, because, you know, again, like I came of age in the 90s and early 2000s, and that whole wave of like watching the world change after 9/11 and that vehement, there was a lot of, you know, Islamophobia in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it was tough because I was going overseas and working in these communities and like, I'm not seeing it. These are my friends. Like these are people that I love and work with. And so, I was reassured after, you know, everything that happened with Afghanistan, when people came here, a lot of Americans from both sides of the political aisle were out there just saying like, we need to help these people. We need to help people that are coming here and have nothing. And they've been through this horrible experience. And we've been in Afghanistan for 20 years. You know, it just was a whole, I felt like it was a unifying event at that time. And I wish there was still more of that spirit when it comes to some of the immigrant communities that are being vilified and targeted today.
Well, Minneapolis, I think there is. It's just, it's being localized when it gets bad.
Yeah.
When there's an invasion from the government, shall we say.
Yeah.
I just want to ping you about the technical writing only because it's in your description, it's in your LinkedIn. It says technical writer. Did you just fall into that, or did you take any classes, or was it just something that you sort of learned by osmosis throughout the career doing other things? Because, you know, there are classes, like you can get a degree in technical writing, but how did you get to do that?
So it was basically, we were trained by the Department of Defense. Yeah, so the contract that I was hired for, when I said we were teaching cross-cultural skills and foreign language to U.S. troops, there were U.S. DOD representatives who were supervising our contract, but we're a third-party contractor. And they would say to us, like, this is how we need this to look, or this is how we want the course to be designed for these troops. Like, they've only got 6 weeks to learn. We need to get them from this level of language to this level of language, whether it was Arabic, Somali, Tagalog, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so my job was to basically write like these technical scenarios that these soldiers could find them in overseas, whether it was, you know, going to a key leader engagement or training, you know, U.S. troops training Iraqi troops on a firearms range, like very technical specific things to the military that may involve these troops having to use the foreign language. And so I would take what the U.S. military wanted to be in the course and design like a template in English. And then we had these language teams, like 6 or 7 language teams, basically not translate, but, you know, take that English template and work it into their specific language and culture. And then I'd go back and look at each one and make sure it was aligned to what the military had said they wanted in the course. So, but it's much more like military technical writing than, you know, any other technical writing, but, yeah, it was aligned to these scales that the military uses to determine, like at what stage somebody is. So we, you know, there's the ACTFL scoring system. They use the OPI, like the oral proficiency interview standards, for the U.S. military. And I mean, those are things you can Google, they're public knowledge, but they basically have like benchmarks that, you know, people need to get to, and different language learning levels. And so that was what we were working towards, was using those scales and systems to get those troops where they needed to be.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So we're now up to 2022. So what's been happening between then and now?
So I found myself after all that, after COVID, a lot of the work overseas dried up. The contracts were not happening or just never re-upped. And as we all know, you know, the war on terror came to a close. So a lot of the work that I was doing either doesn't exist now, or it's just so highly competitive because there's so little of it. So I didn't have a job. After that, I ended up coming up to Maine. And I have a good friend that I grew up with that lives up here. And I originally grew up in Connecticut. So, you know, my friend from Connecticut moved up here and told me, hey, there's a lot of folks from the Angolan and Congolese communities that are in Maine now. And a lot of the school systems need ESL teachers because the kids are in schools and they don't have enough English teachers. So I came and worked a year up here in a public school in Maine. And I had never done like school age education. All of my contracts overseas and all the work I did in DC was adult education in essence. Even when I was doing like refugee resettlement work, it was all adult refugees that I was teaching to. So I worked in a middle school for a year here. And I was like, this isn't for me. I loved the kids. I absolutely loved and adored them. But just working in that environment as an educator, it was more the challenges of working within a public school system that was struggling for resources and all of the challenges that come with that. And I just thought I can't do that long term. And so I left that job. In the meanwhile, I was starting to compile a bunch of short stories from my time in the Peace Corps and my time working in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and had put together basically a book. And I didn't know if that was going to get published or not. In the meanwhile, I got an opportunity to apply with a local law enforcement agency. And I had never envisioned that as a career choice for myself, especially going to my early 40s to make that kind of career switch. But I had just, I think, gone into so many different environments overseas where it felt like a pretty cool challenge for me to try to pursue that. And I think that a lot of the work I've done has been trying to serve the communities that I work with and serve the public and serve this country. I was when I came back from Afghanistan, I was very interested in working for the intelligence communities and federal law enforcement, but I was pretty aged out of a lot of those opportunities, unfortunately. So when the opportunity arose here to apply to a local police department, I thought this would be a really cool opportunity. I would like to be able to use those skills that I have gained, like all of this world knowledge, you know, and serve my local community. Mm-hmm. I love living here. I just didn't enjoy the teaching job that I came up here for. And I wasn't quite ready to leave Maine. So I've been here now the past few years, working this job. I'm a 43 going on 44 year old patrol officer, who works night shift. But I mentioned to you before we began the interview that, we have, again, a lot of folks in the community that are new immigrants to the country. We have a huge asylum seeker population and we deal with them on a daily basis. I do a lot of traffic stops. I'm gravitating towards pursuing a traffic specialty. And so one of the coolest things I get to do with my job is speak to people roadside. A lot of them, you know, they're still learning the rules of the road and getting to have conversations in French with people. Mm. A lot of the drivers we encounter on the road, who, you know, may be committing a traffic infraction that they don't know about, or they're confused when you ask them for their registration and insurance, because like they're just not familiar with the names of the paperwork. I have a lot of officers that I work with that'll call me on the phone. They're like, "Hey, I just pulled someone over," and they speak French. Like they're from Congo, and can you speak to them on the, you know, can you help me translate? And so I use my French a lot more now than I ever have in my entire life, like on a daily basis. And I think it's a good thing. Like I work for a very diverse department. We have folks that speak a variety of different languages. We have officers that speak Portuguese, Arabic. So we have a few folks from a few different countries that I think that helps, again, like build trust with the community when you're able to interact with somebody in their language. It's like this, you can see the relief on their face when you approach them in a situation where, you know, the police have to get involved, whether it's a traffic stop or, you know, a disturbance or some misunderstanding, you know, and then you show up and you can speak their language. It's like, oh my God, like for them, that's huge, because depending on where people come from in the world, they might not trust local law enforcement, or they might be afraid of them, or especially in the environment going on now, they might be very afraid to see somebody in uniform show up to a very routine community interaction. Like I might be stopping someone because they have a broken taillight and they think that they're going to be deported, you know, 5 minutes later. That's not what we do. My job is to make sure that they're safe on the road and that they understand, you know, what they need to do to get something fixed. And like, I just try to let people know, like, we're here to help you and keep you safe. Like you have no reason to be afraid of me. Like, you know, we're not allowed to ask about immigration status. It's not our job. So, but again, like this has been something I didn't foresee as a career change. And if you asked me 10 years ago, if I would be doing a job like this, I would have thought you were crazy. But I love the fact that there's this huge cross-cultural component to it. And I get to use that knowledge and that language. There's people in the community that speak Arabic, and that those little phrases that I learned in the UAE, you know, like those come in handy. And again, it's a de-escalation tactic. It takes down barriers. It's just when people know that you want to take the time to even learn a little bit of their language or have learned a little bit of their culture, it's huge in building respect and trust. And so I feel fortunate that I'm part of a department that really, like that was a big part of why they hired me, you know, and they really do, what's the word I'm looking for? I just feel like they cherish having officers that have a diverse, set of like world views and world experiences. And it definitely helps us, you know, in the community that we serve.
Yeah.
So you never know like where it's going to come in handy is what I'm saying.
Yeah. It sounds like linguistics is still like a huge part of what you do.
It is. Yep. Definitely.
Wow, what a journey. That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing all that. Do you feel like I know like you have a job and you do that. Are there other things that you want to make time for or will be doing that are more in line with some of the other things that you might do? Like, would you if you had time, would you be volunteering time to teach people English again or things like that? Or are you really just focused on your employment right now?
Well, working as a night shifter is a grind. So it's
I get it.
You don't really have like a lot of energy even on your days off, but I'm still, so I'm putting the finishing touches on this book of short stories that I'm working on. And I'm part of a writing group here. So that's my little outside of work hobby that still connects me to like that part of my life. I mean, I have thought about, you know, picking up some teaching some classes, but until I have like the time to do that, I don't want to commit. But the book is basically my journey like through the Peace Corps and working overseas. And the whole point of me wanting to put those short stories together was to give people an introduction to these experiences that I've had and like introduce them to these cultures. So for me, the work that I was doing in 2021 with the Afghan evacuation efforts and writing op-eds and appealing to Congress and posting on my social media accounts that I had at the time was to introduce Americans to Afghans, to humanize them. I would write stories about, you know, the guys that I taught with and some of the interpreters I worked with. And it's just like, these are just, they're just their dads, their husbands, you know, they had a day job in their country that was, they signed up to be a soldier. And at the end of the day, they have kids that they want to go home to and they just want to provide for their families. Like they're no different from you and I. So my hope in, you know, putting this together and hopefully getting this published at some point is just to be like another window into these worlds, to let people in and learn about Niger and learn about Afghanistan and learn about some of the people I met along the way that changed my life. You know, again, for people that might not be able to pursue those opportunities or haven't gotten to get out into the world yet, it's like this, these are possibilities and these people exist out there. And, you know, I feel very, very lucky that I've met the people I have in the places that I've gone. What I want to achieve with the book is just to introduce people to some of the things that I've gotten to see and do. And I think when you connect people to other people, even if it's through a book, it's still making that, forging that human connection. And that's the only thing I think we have to combat, you know, that ability to divide is just to keep trying to bring people together.
Yeah, no, totally. That's so cool. And so cool that you're writing a book about it. That's amazing. So thank you so much for talking about all this today. What a story. It's like amazing. What an amazing journey that you've had. I am going to put links to your LinkedIn profile. Is it okay if people contact you via LinkedIn if they want to get in touch with you for advice or maybe do an informational interview? Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have LinkedIn, Facebook, and all that.
Okay.
I also have a writing website. It may or may not be on my LinkedIn, but it's got some of those essays and op-eds from all the Afghanistan advocacy as well.
Cool. That is great. Well, I'm sure that people will be in touch with you because it sounds like you have plenty of advice to offer to people. And this, your career path is definitely so interesting and so exciting. People have definitely approached us to try to get information about government jobs or government adjacent jobs. And I think we have interviewed far few people who have had the kind of experiences that you have. And I know that there are folks out there who are really interested in this. So
that's good to hear.
Yeah, there will be people who will want to contact you.
Awesome.
So Joan, thank you so much for your time today. This has been terrific. And we're going to be talking to you in the future. When your book comes out, we will definitely have you back on to talk about it.
Awesome. That would be so cool. Thank you so much.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.